want to get going. My name is Donette Dunaway. I work with the Regional Water Quality Control Board, and I'd like to thank you all for coming. I will be introducing speakers today. We have a wonderful lineup. I'm very excited about it. I'm just going to start out this morning and give you kind of the overview of some of the basics that you need to know. Hopefully you all grabbed the handouts on your way in, and there's a lot of good information in there. I'd particularly like to point out there's a handout with a lot of resources on it, including websites and information on how you can get a video. We are videotaping this session today, so that can be ordered through AGP Video, and that information's in your handouts as well as a lot of other good information. Hopefully you also found the coffee and goodies over in the room just right behind us. Bathrooms are down this hall and to the left, and then you'll find them on the right-hand side. And I'd like to also remind you to turn your cell phones to no ring, please. And with all that kind of business out of the way, I would like to introduce our welcome speaker, Mr. Jim Patterson. I've known Jim for a while now, as he worked for the Atascadero Mutual Water Company. He was very wonderful to work with there and did a lot of good work then. He's now working as supervisor of District 5 in the county of San Luis Obispo up in Atascadero. So, Mr. Patterson.
Good morning. Thank you, Donette. It's my pleasure to welcome all of you to what I hope is only the first in an ongoing dialogue about how we can live better with the land. I'm pleased to welcome you all to San Luis Obispo County on what's another near perfect but typical day in San Luis Obispo. San Luis Obispo County, for those of you that aren't from here, is unique in its diversity of climate, topography, and habitats. We have coastal beaches and dunes, the Santa Lucia Mountains, going east through mixed oak woodlands all the way out to the vast grasslands of the Carrizo Plains. And the 5th District of San Luis Obispo, which is the one I represent, starts here in the city of San Luis and goes north. We have sparsely populated farming communities out to the east, and then the higher density urban and educational type environments of San Luis Obispo and Cal Poly, which is where I just came from. I was attending and will return to an economic summit that's going on at Cal Poly, and it's refreshing to be here among you after leaving that environment more structured and all the suits and ties that are over at Cal Poly talking about the economy. I'm pleased that we have a forum here in San Luis Obispo talking about the environment and hopefully how to integrate the two. San Luis Obispo is challenged, like much of the South Central Coast and the rest of the state of California, in managing the explosive growth that we're experiencing. Fortunately, I've had the opportunity, as Donette said, to work in a variety of water-related issues over the past several years, and I've learned that the community as a whole has a growing awareness of the importance and the critical nature of water to our quality of life. And San Luis Obispo County has a great diversity in our water resources. We have huge groundwater basins, some inland rivers, we've got reservoirs, coastal and inland streams. And with all of that abundance, we still have regions of the county that are plagued with water quantity and water quality issues. So the topic that we're discussing today is very important and germane to the future of San Luis Obispo County. And what I'm happy to see happening today with this great lineup of speakers that you have talking about a wide range of topics is the integration of the art of building communities with the science of creating the infrastructure and required of a living, viable community, and the protection of the environment that we must do if we're going to maintain the quality of life and the health of the planet as a whole. And so, again, I welcome you to San Luis Obispo, the science of community building and resource protection. And I want to leave you with this one thought. It comes from Luna Leopold, who is the son of Aldo Leopold, and most of us know him, the author of the Sand County Almanac. It's been around for a few decades, but still one of the very important environmental books in the community. And Luna Leopold said, and he is an internationally known hydrologist and professor, followed in the footsteps of his father, though leaned a little bit more towards water than land. And Luna said that water is the most critical issue of our lifetime and our children's lifetime. And it's the quality of our waters that measure how we live on the land. So I'll leave you with that. Welcome again to San Luis Obispo County, and enjoy your day. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. I'd like to now introduce our next speaker, Paavo Ogren, and he is the Deputy Director of Public Works of San Luis Obispo County. He is leading the team that prepared the San Luis Regional Integrated Water Management Plan, which I'm told is called Earworm for short, and the Stormwater Management Program. He has also put a lot of the sustainability ideas into his own life, I guess, as he replumbed his own home and put in a gray water irrigation system and utilized native landscaping, which we'll hear about again today. So, Paavo, welcome.
Good morning. For those of you who have heard me speak before, I think you'll be relieved to note that we're actually going to begin with a video of the chairperson of our Board of Supervisors, Shirley Bianchi.
Kid, and I'd come up around at that time. When I came to San Luis Obispo County, as I was a little bit older, the county was mostly cattle ranching on this side of the mountain, and there was some barley growing on or dry farming on the other side. It was long before the vineyards ever came in. The ocean and the creeks were spectacular. The countryside was really fabulous. Now, as our region grows, it's really critical for us that we ensure that we grow smart and we don't further damage our watersheds and our oceans. It's really important that we do this because we have to think of our future generations that come. We have to think about our children, our grandchildren, and our grandchildren's grandchildren. We have to be really careful and plan for at least 7 generations. You know, I'm also a member of the Board of Directors of the Local Government Commission, and it was the local government position that put together the Ioane principles that indicate how we need to grow smart to ensure that our resources can be sustained, which of course is a lot easier said than done. But there are some tools to help us. In low impact development technology aims to preserve the natural hydrology of our watersheds by reducing impervious surface area, such as asphalt and concrete, and increasing infiltration to reduce stormwater runoff. More simply, LID uses more natural vegetation, less concrete, and fewer pipes than older stormwater management approaches. smart growth principles help to guide us in land use decisions to reduce sprawl and continued overdependence on private transportation. Smart growth moves us closer to living locally again. And integrated regional water management integrates planning efforts so we can collaborate on a regional scale in a holistic sense, in that we consider all aspects of water resource management: water supply, water quality, ecosystems, groundwater, and flood management. I urge you as citizens, business people, and government to learn more about these tools and help implement them on the Central Coast. By using an adaptive management approach, we will learn by doing so we can continue to improve. So, let's get started. Future generations will thank you.
I was introduced as a deputy director for San Luis Obispo County Public Works Department. And so my purpose in coming here to speak today is really on our general perspective. I work on policy management, work on issues with elected officials. I certainly do not get into the level of technical details that many of the experts are going to be speaking today. Jill Falcone was one of the instrumental people in bringing this event together today. She's an environmental resource specialist in our department. And I always find it interesting with somebody who theoretically reports to you, comes up to you with a request to do something like speak today, and she's got the look in her eye that it's not really a request, but it's a demand. She's done a wonderful job, and there's themes today that are going to be discussed with respect to change. You know, change how we do development, and changes in how the human environment relates with the natural environment. And to reflect a little bit on Jill's position as an environmental resource specialist within a public works department, I worked with our director a few years ago in approaching the Board of Supervisors on budget changes so that we could get environmental resource specialists within public works. It was a change that we felt was very necessary a few years ago, based on, in part, some challenges that we were facing, and also in part on, you know, the reality of vision of what the future is all about. Government is often slow to change. That can be a good thing, because with government we need stability. But at the same time, we need to focus in on how do we have to change in order to meet the needs of the future. There's a couple of quotes from elected officials who are no longer alive that we wanted to share. The nation behaves well if it treats natural resources as assets which it must turn over to the next generation, increased and not impaired in value. Mr. Theodore Roosevelt. And the earth belongs to each generation during its course, fully and in its own right. No generation can contract debts greater than may be paid during the course of its own existence. Thomas Jefferson. You know, clearly our elected officials in this country have recognized from the beginning the importance of our natural resources. Today's elected officials continue with recognizing that need. And as one of the lead staff individuals in a governmental organization, it's important that we listen very carefully to the elected officials. 100 was 1.5 million people, and today it's 33 million people. Los Angeles had 102,000 people. Today it's got 13.5 million people. I think San Luis Obispo County maybe had 2 farmers, 4 cows, and a pig. Today we're big enough that we can actually support a Costco. That itself had controversies. It points, though, to the recognition that the growth in the demand on the water cycle that occurred in the 20th century, that rate of growth simply cannot be sustained. Elements of conservation, and conservation is important, but conservation itself will have limits. There are going to be many, many different strategies that have to be implemented in order to make sure that the quality of life in future generations is maintained. 3 of the concepts that will be discussed today under the umbrella of sustainability is low impact development, smart growth, and integrated regional water management. And I think in the introduction, it was noted that the area that we in Public Works have focused on is in the integrated regional water management aspects. Nevertheless, Jill wanted me just to touch briefly on a couple of the other items. Low-impact development is about letting it soak in. Certainly, we've already seen over the decades changes in the designs of flood control or drainage facilities. The use of trapezoidal concrete channels is perhaps still occurring from time to time. We still see proposals that are submitted that maybe are antiquated or more traditional. But in any case, you know, low-impact development and trying to get the recharges into the groundwater is important. We're glad to be able to speak that the largest groundwater basin that we have in our county, the Paso Robles Groundwater Basin, November 8th of this year, the Board of Supervisors adopted for the first time a groundwater management and monitoring agreement that included the city of Paso Robles and several landowners in the North County, and we're optimistic about the initiation of that agreement for the better monitoring of our groundwater basins. Smart growth itself, in contrast to low-impact development, low-impact development is a technology, it's methodology. Smart growth maximizes uses of infrastructure. One is more of the technology, the other is more of the philosophies. In integrated regional water management planning, the single most important item that we liked about the IRWM approach, anybody can look to and see what is going on. It's a first generation document. We look to make significant improvements over time on it. One of the central themes of the integrated regional management plan, in addition to what is going on right now, it's really in the future. How do we take a document, make sure that it doesn't just collect dust on the shelves, and it's used as a living document? And therein, what we did is we incorporated this performance evaluation process. Rather than just create a plan, and then also within it, create a method of evaluating how our region is doing in implementing its goals and objectives. So in the center of this diagram, it's the IRWM performance. And what we did is we developed a model that says that there's four critical components to evaluating how we are moving in the future in meeting our goals and objectives. One is simply institutional effectiveness. And whether that's the county of San Luis Obispo or it's the different agencies, there are a number of different governmental entities that work on water resources. There's cities, there's community services districts, channel maintenance districts, irrigation districts. In meeting a certain institutional effectiveness, what is the best type of organization to do so? And it's very similar to private companies. Private companies have corporations and partnerships, different types of nonprofits, different types of corporations to meet those goals and objectives. And from the perspective of the Public Works Department in the county, we are not always the best entity. There's fiscal issues. Certainly, when we look to the future, we expect that some of the goals and objectives that may be more difficult to meet are those that are strictly related to the environmental objectives. When environmental mitigation is associated with a capital works project, then it's more likely to get implemented. But some of the big challenges on the environmental side is the lack of funding. Again, when it's tied to capital projects, it's more feasible. When it's not, it's more difficult. Community acceptance. We certainly have some major infrastructure projects in our region that have had great difficulty in getting forward movement because of community acceptance. And the last one is the importance of the regulatory environment. Your next speaker has got one of the biggest hammers in the region regarding regulatory. And it's important that we recognize that the regulatory front is every bit as important of changes and promoting changes. Thank you again for allowing us.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Mr. Roger Briggs, who is the executive officer of the place where I work, the Regional Water Quality Control Board. And he has been a strong proponent of watershed management as well as this low-impact development concept. And with that, I'd like to welcome him here. Thanks.
Let's see. I'm going to start with a video that's of my last vacation. I've edited it down to just under 2 hours. But I kid. Where's the... Pardon? Oh, there it is. As Donette said, I'm with the Water Quality Control Board. Well, what's the water quality connection with this business about how much water runs off? I think the answer goes back to the hydrologic cycle, which Paavo mentioned in terms of how we interrupt the hydrologic cycle. Here's where we vacation. It's a little chunk of the region, I suppose. And you'll notice that this is supposed to be a kind of pre-intense development. And people use the term, you know, development kind of loosely. We're really talking about land changes because if there's grazing, it's a land use. It's just if you have impervious surfaces, it's a change in land use. But notice the runoff percentage here. 10% with this relatively undeveloped, typical type undeveloped watershed. Well, the rain that doesn't evaporate or recharge goes to runoff. And so if we looked at a sort of more developed, more impervious surface watershed, you notice the runoff now has changed to 55% from 10%. With more runoff, you get not only just more water running off, that's not the issue, but also you have flashier flows, higher peaks. What's the problem with that? Well, with higher peaks, we generally carry more pollutants. They actually have the ability to carry more trash. They're more likely to bypass the pollutant control structures that we have downstream, or we may have downstream, filter devices and drop inlets and that kind of thing. And the flashier the flows, the more they can overwhelm those things, which means more pollutants are going to head on downstream. When that increased phenomena of higher runoff, higher peaks can change the structure of drainage ways and creeks by way of more side cutting and down cutting. That in itself releases more sediments, can cause more problems downstream, damages riparian corridors by cutting, and can actually create barriers to fish migration. So it's not a good trend. Looking at it from the other standpoint, in terms of the recharge, what are the effects of reduced recharge? If we look at, go back to the first slide, of course, groundwater recharges and provides base flow for the creeks. And hopefully, in some cases, provides base flow year-round. With less recharge, the groundwater level typically lowers, and that, of course, can have water supply implications, and that's an important aspect here in our region, because in so many areas of our region, we actually rely on local groundwater for water supply. But the lower levels reduce the base flow in the creeks, and that reduces the habitat. Historically, perennial creeks can become ephemeral with a reduced vitality of habitat and reduced fisheries. That's the trend in much of California. As far as how we're typically changing land uses in the watershed, it's a downward spiral for water quality and for fish and for our own quality of life, as Paavo touched on. It doesn't make economic sense either. In a lot of cases, life cycle costs can actually be cheaper for low-impact development. The title of my talk, Why Are Low-Impact Development, Smart Growth, Integrated Regional Water Management Planning Important for the Central Coast Region? These concepts are important everywhere, but of utmost importance on the Central Coast. We have much more potential for shaping our future than urban areas like Los Angeles or San Diego, where most of their areas can only deal with redevelopment and where riparian corridor improvement or preservation opportunities have been lost. We have many more options with a lot of our riparian corridors, not only for protection, but for improvement. And of course, we have a higher percentage of our watersheds that have not been changed into impervious land uses. One of my colleagues at another region who's been in the water quality field for decades said that he thought that we could solve 80% of our significant surface water quality problems by simply protecting riparian corridors and simply recharging more water. It's a pretty simple, as a regulatory agency for over a decade, through joint efforts with local watershed groups, through use of settlement funds from enforcement actions to establish conservation easements, improve riparian corridors, preserve them, through emphasis on tangible, long-lasting results in our watersheds. Our board is not only been supportive of these efforts, but has been proactive in doing everything it can to further true watershed management. The board is keenly interested in moving low-impact development forward. The board's gone into the field to see low-impact development projects firsthand, and we've had board meeting presentations and discussion on this topic. In September, our board approved our proposed use of settlement funds to assist one of our cities with low-impact development and actual implementation, and this workshop is a part of that process. So welcome to all of you, and thank you, and including folks from outside the region. Some of you have come quite a ways. And I appreciate you taking your valuable time to come and learn from each other to share strategies for how we can collectively shape the future of our watersheds in a positive way. Special thanks to the presenters for their extra time and effort to share their knowledge and experiences, our staff who assisted in putting this together, to the County of San Luis Obispo and the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary, who are co-sponsors of the event. I look forward to our discussions today. I've already had some interesting discussions this morning. And lastly, I'd like everybody to give a hand to our key person in putting this conference together, Donette Dunaway.
That was very kind. All right. Over the next hour, we have three speakers who I'm very excited to introduce. They have come down from Seattle. They work with the Seattle Public Utilities. And the Seattle has been very instrumental in putting forth low-impact development, both in retrofit and in new development as well. So we are going to glean a lot of information from these three speakers. The first person you'll hear from is Darla Inglis. I hope I'm saying your last name correctly. She manages the Surface Water Quality Program for Seattle. Her team develops and manages capital projects, programs, and maintenance activities for Seattle. In addition, she is the lead for the city's stormwater MPDES permit. The second person that you'll hear from is Denise Andrews, and Denise utilizes naturalistic design alternatives for achieving water quality treatment, stormwater volume reduction, and peak flow reduction. And she was the lead designer for the C Streets retrofit program that you may have heard about or will hear about that decreased stormwater runoff volumes by 99%, just exactly what Roger's talking about here. So I'd like to introduce these three wonderful speakers, and please welcome them. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. I really, really appreciate being here. It started raining last month in Seattle, and it won't stop till April, so we are really appreciating your weather. We don't understand why you have any runoff problem. Today, I'm going to start out, and Darla's going to, I think, pitch in as we go. And I'm going to talk first, and then what we'll do is we'll do some question and answers, and then we'll turn it over to Tracy. But let me see if I can get this going here. So I love to start with this slide. This is an actual sign that Darla went to a conference, and there was the Full Gospel Water Quality Program. There were actually two groups that day. But we like to think we're here to spread the gospel of water quality, but we're always talking to the choir, right? Pretty generally. And so I wanted to see who was in the choir today by occupation, because that kind of helps us direct our talk. How many actual stormwater engineers are here today? Raise your hand. Ah, this is great. We have a couple. How about municipal planners in the stormwater field? Landscape architecture type people? Why do you guys always sit in the back? I don't know why. There you go. And another very important group to me is transportation people. Transportation planners, managers. Great. I promise not to say anything bad about you today. So let's get going. I want to talk about our team. I think one of the reasons we've been successful is that we bring different aspects to the push to bring natural drainage systems to Seattle. And very fortunately, we have Darla Inglis, who's her scientific background, especially in an extremely urbanized setting for water quality was the basis for the program. And we have Tracy Tackett, who mine is more from a political standpoint, helping us look in what our next opportunity is politically. What I try to do is break down the barriers or any blockages for these two. Mostly my talent happens to be that I actually enjoy conflict, which most people don't. So that's what I bring to it, but they're the brains. So the question here that maybe you're thinking, and maybe you didn't know this, but we spend $4 million a year on our natural drainage systems capital program alone. That is a fifth of our entire capital budget for a year, which I know $20 million sounds like a lot when you're in a smaller jurisdiction. But we're a large city, we're ratepayer-based. What's important to know about this is this was not that easy to do. We started in 1999 with one project, and where we are 6 years later, we made an exponential growth in it leaps ahead. And now this program is institutionalized in our comprehensive drainage plan. Our engineers, it's the default. They have to look for ways to do this in a natural approach rather than a piped approach. It's the default, not the exception. To encourage you, it was just 6 years in a major metropolitan area that we were able to make this shift. And you know, the question is, excuse me, I did that wrong. How do I get out of that? Escape. Thank you. Here's a picture of our city. And one of the similarities I think we have to you is that water resources are also really sensitive where we are as well. We have, to the left, Puget Sound. I don't have a pointer. Maybe this is the pointer. Nope. Oop. That wasn't the pointer. See why they don't put me in charge of any technology. Okay, so Puget Sound is a marine water body. And you can see we still have our creek systems, maybe unlike San Diego. We have remnant systems that are, we still have five species of salmon that come into our city to try to spawn. And I say try. But they're remarkable. After 10,000 years, we still haven't killed them off. They're still trying to come in and breed, and we intend within the next 50 years to make sure they can do that in a sustainable fashion. Thank you. So on the right, we have our freshwater body, Lake Washington, that flows into Puget Sound. And this is the north third of the entire city. So you can see the level of density. We have us doesn't work. It doesn't works well for flooding control, but that's not all that's important anymore. I mean, every time you see those creeks, the water bodies, regulatory, citizen action, everyone wants cleaner water. We know that. So we're not just about mitigating flooding any longer. So when you think of that, and we think that we've used these pipes and in more suburban areas, large ponds to control flooding, we were successful at that. But what happens when your objectives for what your drainage system must do changes? What happens when you need really high water quality and you want to protect your aquatic biota, whatever that is? And I had a picture of a bug, you know, water bug. I mean, that's where it starts. I mean, you need to have the bugs in the creek system so that the fish can eat the bugs and, the chain of life that you're trying to protect. You want to protect your channel erosion. And at the same time, especially in a, suburban or urban environment, you want people to be able to be more mobile with less cars and more, bike and walking in their neighborhoods, and especially in a place in an urban environment. And as you redevelop, in the Seattle area, we want to increase our tree cover. So when you think of our old drainage systems, it's just not possible to utilize that old system if these are your new objectives. So there's my creek bug. I just love that picture. So in a traditional approach, what we tried to do, and we were successful at, was we collected all this water, we moved it from point A to point B, and then we'd take care of it over there in point B. So what this did is we did avoid flooding. We still have some flooding issues in the city of Seattle, but not terrible ones, and for the most part, they've been taken care of. But we have lousy water quality. We've moved that stormwater to the creeks. We have CSO overflows. It overwhelms our combined system. And we've been using pipes and concrete vaults. These are our tools. And now when we trigger a water quality project in a road project, as many of you transportation folks are familiar, the vaults we're having to put in for water quality are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and they really don't work well. And we know they don't work well, but we have run up against a wall, and we don't know what else to do. But we do know what else to do now. There is an alternative. Now, when we look at a city, here's a typical north end Seattle neighborhood that's about 35% impervious surface. We know that we cannot build with pipes and vaults our way out of this pickle. We're not going to reach a lot-by-lot basis. But for right now, our approach will be street-by-street. And we're going to try to replicate that natural hydrologic cycle. And I'm not the scientist here, and I made this very simple chart. But, you know, as I saw one of the last slides, it talked about, you know, what happens when the rain hits the landscape. Well, what we're trying to do is copy that function of the hydrologic cycle, the function that that forest provided. And our objectives now will be to reduce those flows so that the water does not flood those creek systems, is not bringing all that sediment with pollutants attached to it to the creek systems and out to our oceans. We want very high quality water quality treatment. And this is the key to most of it, is you have to reduce the total volume. The total volume of stormwater being generated by these impervious surfaces can't just be managed somewhere else, whether it's in a huge pond or just sent out to the ocean. It's the volume that's killing us, especially in your creek systems. And as someone pointed out, the answer is infiltration. Well, infiltration is attainable. Infiltration means you put it back in the soil, and you do it in a way that's cost-effective. So when we look back at our city, someday I'd like to be able to say that, you know, the water that's dropping on this landscape, whatever's reaching those creek systems, is what reached those creek systems 100 years ago. I mean, that would be our objective. What I'm going to do now is a quick overview of the projects that we actually built. Here's the fun part, we get to see pictures. So this is a picture of the Pipers Creek watershed. And in the little red dot here was the very first project we did in 1999 called C Street. And here's one key point in how do you kick this stuff off in your area? Well, you call it a pilot project, so no one gets uptight. Especially your electeds like it when you call it a pilot project. We're just going to try it. And if it doesn't work, we'll just put it back the way it was. And, you know, when we don't have not a huge chunk of money, this was probably, I think we spent $800,000 on this project, and which was about $300,000 more than we would spend on it now, because now we know what we're doing. Back then, we didn't know what we were doing. And so this is part of the neighborhoods way to the north, where it's sort of like some of the neighborhoods maybe you have, where we don't have drainage infrastructure yet. It's a great opportunity because we don't have to rip the pipes out of the ground. There are no pipes in the ground. There's no drainage whatsoever. It's flowing overland to some ditches along the side of the road. But it's only, from this picture, two blocks to this creek system where salmon are trying to spawn, grown up around it. But what we have is highly engineered system. You're looking at highly engineered nature. The swale systems that Tracy has designed, there's a certain criteria for what size storm that they will infiltrate. We have certain criteria for how long ponding can remain in those swales. We have lots of criteria that's built into this system. What happens when it overflows? And you can see we've changed the street design. That's the other key point. This seems to be the hardest point of all, is changing institutionalized ideas of what street design should be. And it's all around the concept of safety and risk. And one point I'll leave you with at the end is think in terms of risk being different, not necessarily increased. But it seems that since we've been designing our streets for 100 years in a grid system, and we've gotten to the point where all the safety ideas about has really revolved around moving cars, and it's a very, very difficult tradition to break. And I'm not going to say it was easy. There was some blood spilled on the walls with our transportation department initially over how to break street design standards. And We're at the point today where we have reached a mutual understanding because we have worked very hard at bringing a benefit to the transportation department. I'll talk more about that in a minute. Here's one of these swales, close-ups, zeroing in. You can see the overflow structure. Now, this is the street from the air shortly after it was built. You can see we put the curve into the street. And part of why Tracy designed it that way is so that we could fit swales in on either side of the street and had more flexibility. So where the water is draining from the topography is from up here at the top. There's about, I think, 2% grade, Tracy? 1 to 2, something like that?
A half to two
in certain places. And it's all discharging at this point, except that it has never discharged. So, you know, this was the first project out. I think Tracy did a little over-engineering of the system to make sure it worked really well. And we had a 100-year storm for Seattle back in 2003, October of 2003. It hadn't rained prior to that for about 5 months, so we had dry soils all around. I think that helped us quite a bit. But we did not discharge from the street in the 100-year storm. That means we infiltrated the 100-year storm under excellent conditions. And what that means is you didn't have runoff from this street. It's just one street. We run them downstream so that they enter the food chain. We want to keep the carbon-based pollutants in the soil where they can be remediated when they are not overloaded by soil microbes. So we've essentially solved for one 600-foot block, 2.3 acres of Seattle, we solved a stormwater problem. Now, it's expensive. We can't retrofit every street in the next 10 years in the Seattle streets. So we thought, okay, we need a bigger bang for our buck. So let's take a larger area. Here's a picture of the before. So all those side streets are draining into these now east-west streets that go directly to the creek, and they're much steeper. This is about a what percent grade? 6% grade. So in a good-sized storm, all that area drains to this street, and it's a straight shot to the creek carrying those pollutants and sediments. So we decided to try something that's more focused on water quality benefit. So we're going to get as much infiltration as we can out of the project. What we want to do is get very high levels of water quality through what we call a hybrid system. I think we finally figured out there was about 70 acres of stormwater going through this system.
That's one block away. This one's more like 25 acres.
Oh, okay. I stand corrected. 25 acres coming through this system. And they're high pollution generating area. We have Greenwood Avenue is a very major arterial coming through this system. So it's a series of catch basins, several places where we can actually send the Vactor truck, suck out the majority of the sediments, and then what I call secondary treatment through these natural systems. This is the system right after we built it. We got some plants in, and we had the 100-year storm. Of course, we all ran out there to see, you know, if we were destroying people's homes and if we needed to leave the city immediately and find jobs elsewhere in California. But it worked really well. And here's the reason, here's how I'm going to show you it worked really well. This imagine the system is four blocks long. It's a series of larger cells, larger than the C Street, about 12 of them. And they go for about four blocks in series. And this is the top of the hill. So this is where it's coming off that very major arterial. And it's hard to see here, but that's an icky mud covered first swale. Lots of ickiness in there. Remember, it hadn't rained for 5 months. We had a very dry summer followed by this huge storm. And it carried all of that thick mud with the pollutants into this first cell. And four blocks away, you can see the clean gravels at the bottom of the hill. Now, all that sediment prior to putting in this project would have gone to the creek system. And I've had people say to me, well, you know, if you had catch basins in there, then you would have taken care of it. No, it would have flooded 15 streets. Let's take an entire sub-basin, which is what the red line is, with one discharge point to the creek, and say, okay, we're going to put in the C streets, we're going to put in the cascade prototypes, and then we're going to see at this point how much of this 32-acre area that we are going to be able to reduce the volume of stormwater going to the creek. And when we reduce the volume, we're obviously reducing the pollutant loading. So we, is that our street? No. Yes? Oh, that's C Street. But some of the streets look like this, but here's the second generation design. We worked with Transportation Department on some of the issues that came up in the first design, which is we always have a transportation planner on our team. And then we argue and negotiate, and we work on it, and we test, and we say, okay, let's try it this time, and if it doesn't work, we'll change it. And you can see now that the sidewalk is adjacent to the roadway. Before, it was on the other side of the swale, but no one was using it. So a lot of this is about observing. If it hasn't been built before, you don't know how it's going to actually work. In the first C Street, we had, you know, mothers with babies in the strollers going right down the middle of the street because they felt so safe, and they weren't using the sidewalk on the other side. But now most people use the sidewalk because it's adjacent to the street. This is only about an inch and a half lip, so that an emergency vehicle, fire truck, can actually ride, use these extra 5 feet as it drives down the street. There's parking on one side of the street, and we still have swales on both sides of the street. And as it was built, we put in the vegetation. It is very incorporated into the homeowner's front yard. You almost can't tell where it begins and ends, the right-of-way. It's a 60-foot right-of-way, and everything we do is in the right-of-way. Sometimes we have to get permission to do some grading as part of construction back onto private property. But we do a lot of work up front. It's a lot of work with the homeowners to discuss the plantings. Do they want very low-maintenance plantings? How much interest are they going to take in maintaining those plantings? And I know you'll have a question about who does the maintenance of the vegetation. And right now, we're having a huge amount of success with just asking property owners, because it is so integrated with their yards, to please water and weed the plants. And if you can get past those first 3 years successfully, they start maintaining themselves as it fills in. As most gardeners know, when you stop having those empty spaces in between plants, then you pretty much stop having weeds. But many people, I'd say 95%, are doing a fabulous job of maintaining the vegetation. We had very, very few losses of plants due to lack of watering. And this is successful because streets, infrastructure, everything went, and they're just going to start again because they wanted to just make it incredibly much more dense than it is now. It makes sense to do that. And we got in early enough on the project that we could work with the Seattle Housing Authority, who was doing the project. And the reason we were so excited is because this area actually represents 10% of an entire watershed. You can see the creek on the right, which is Longfellow Creek. It has the largest coho run of salmon in the city. And here's a picture of it under, I think they had just finished doing the major rip it all out, and they were starting to put some housing back. And what I wanted to point out is they still have the very large stormwater pond. But what we did was we combined it with, throughout the neighborhood, an LID approach using porous sidewalks, using testing a porous street, infiltration swale. So in other words, what we're doing is we're trying to reduce the runoff in those smaller storms because, as we know, for many people may not know, these stormwater ponds really only control those huge floods. It's the 50-year, it's the 100-year storm that's going to prevent downstream flooding, usually of other properties, right? But what it does not do, since in Seattle, 90% of our rainfall comes in under the two-year storm. So it's not doing anything for the two-year storm, yet those storms are just wreaking havoc on our creek systems because the critters that live in that creek system and the sediment and the banks, erosion, they can't live in a system that you have, you know, intense fluctuations of water coming into it and then dropping off. So in other words, the peak flow that's hitting those creek systems, even in very small storms, even the six-month storm, is unnatural for that creek system. So it doesn't matter how many trees you're going to plant in your riparian corridor. If you can't control the flow of stormwater into that creek system, you will never have a creek system that's going to function in a natural manner. So again, back to that matching the function of the hydrologic cycle. So what is that creek used to experiencing, and trying to limit the impact and the fluctuation of the water hitting that creek system? Ponds don't do it. One of the problems as well with ponds is that they're giant heat sinks. So if you're in the Northwest and water temperature, you're going to be regulated on. We will be regulated on soon. You can't maintain a temperature because you're creating a giant heat sink as well. So even if it's draining slowly back to the creek system, you've increased the temperature in the creek system. So it's not doing anything for the vast majority of storms that we're experiencing. And it's also, from a developer standpoint, I didn't ask how many, but we decided to keep the pond at its current size because we are going to gain extra water quality by utilizing that pond. They had already pretty much planned the pond in by the time we got there, so it wasn't an issue for them, but it's something to consider. So I'm going to try to wind it down here and talk about, now, what does natural drainage systems do for us? Technically, it lowers that peak rate. So in other words, the stormwater that could have gone to that pond in a storm was reduced. So you needed a smaller pond size. You have higher water quality, and we will get proof of that within another year, but anecdotally, we can through our observation, we can show, or just by understanding that if the water doesn't go downstream, then you're not sending pollutants downstream, that we have higher water quality. We're going to shorten the flow duration and reduce total volume. And total volume, again, especially in a sensitive creek or river system, total volume is critical. So, let's see, this is technical. So for those of you who want a little technicalities here, we reduce the runoff volume. The peak runoff from the two-year storm, we want to reduce. We want to remove 80% of TSS for the six-month storm and convey the 5 to 25-year storm. And the reason I put this up is what we're seeing around the country are good attempts at doing LID, but they're taking it from not a technical or engineering enough standpoint. We're saying, well, we're just going to build these swales and we'll just send stormwater to it. But there's so much more to it than that. And that's why we're here, to be able to share the technical information, the hydraulic information, the geologic information, the mistakes we've made and fixed, everything from what is the mix of soils that you put in that swale to actually make it infiltrate. And what we do that I think is very different than most of the country is Tracy and Darla, they have very strict criteria for how the actual stormwater system functions. So we set criteria for, you know, the six-month storm, which for us is our code requirement. The two-year storm, reducing runoff volume. And what we do is use all this information to do a business case. So in other words, when we go out, we've just spent we're planning another project. We plan a project that goes to construction practically every year. We have a new project, and we predict this one may cost, in a traditional sense, if we were to put in those catch basins, we're still using a very strict criteria the way we engineer these systems. This is not willy-nilly. They're highly engineered. So the point is, why are we spending $4 million a year in the city of Seattle? Because it makes economic sense. It makes environmental sense, and we always win the discussion when it comes to cost-benefit. Hands down, we are run through some pretty severe business cases. We have to present to our utility a business case for why this makes sense, and we have to put it up against a traditional system. We haven't lost yet. And that's why the city of Seattle is spending $4 million a year, because we win every time. We provide higher environmental benefit at a lower cost. That's the bottom line. And that's for you, how you can sell your systems to your jurisdictions, because it really comes down to money. Let's face it. I want to leave you with a couple of comments on what I think makes a successful program and how you can succeed in bringing this to your area. One is, you have to make your elected officials very successful. And the reason you can do that is by showing through your business case that you have achieved this environmental benefit at a lower cost. Electeds like that. And you make it pretty. We don't have to spend this much on our systems. We can bring the cost down of these systems. It would not be wise for us to do this right now. Why? Because it's a new concept. We're trying to sell it to citizens. We're trying to sell it to the electeds. The regulatory people already like it because they know they're getting their environmental benefit, but they're not the only ones out there. So I have to make it pretty. We have to bring in the sidewalk. Sure, I'll pay for the sidewalk. Whatever. You want a sidewalk? Here's a sidewalk. You want these nice plants? This system would work with weeds practically, as long as it's got a root system going down into the soil to help the infiltration. But if you make it look great, what you get is what we're getting now. Three times a week I get a citizen calling saying, when are we going to have one on our block? And I say, oh, why don't you ask the mayor? And they send an email to the mayor. So the mayor gets all this great feedback. The mayor gets to be on TV because these things have gotten amazing press. We haven't had one bad story yet about it. I know I said that out loud. Take away the jinx. Anyway, we will someday. Something will go wrong. You know, it's Murphy's Law. At some point something will go wrong. But so far we've already gone so far down the road with the benefit and already have enough good marketing around it, and the proof is in the pudding. Our monitoring is killer. We're showing amazing results on the flow, that it's very well established, so we can withstand a big problem. I think one of the important things to do is educate folks on the the concept of risk. So very definitely different risk, and it is an unproven risk. So in other words, we're just starting to do that, so we have to study very hard and address the issues that are truly there with safety for transportation. But it's different risk, not necessarily increased. And then, of course, if you consider the increased risk to your NPDES permit, or if you're not doing the right things, or to your ratepayers, if you have to go back and spend a lot of money on systems to fix problems that were created in the first place, then that's another take on risk. I think it's important to provide a benefit to your transportation department. One of the ways that we assist and get help from our transportation department is because now when they go to do a major project in the area, one of the areas I showed you, on that large arterial, hey, we already covered your code requirement for water quality on this certain section of the roadway that would have cost you $1 million using those vault systems. Okay, there's a benefit to the transportation department, and we try to provide that benefit because we're getting something back in return. And then one of the last concepts is we can talk about this stuff in theory till the cows come home. You just have to go build it. Because you don't, each time in every different municipality, it's going to be different. You know, we can provide we can provide the basics technically, but it's going to look different. It's going to act different in your jurisdiction. Just try to get the first one built. Monitor it. Make the first one very successful. Make sure the first one works. Because if it does, if the first one is not well designed, you're going to stop right there. So it's critical to make the first one work really well. So I'm going to stop there. We're going to open it to questions just for a few minutes, and then we're going to turn it over to Tracy.
In your project, you were talking about 60-foot easement. It looks like you have quite a large area in front of these homes. Did any of your projects have much narrower easements? I'm thinking about a lot of our lot sizes being much smaller. Did you deal with smaller lot sizes and narrow easements?
Are you talking about lot size or the width of your right-of-way?
Width of the right-of-way.
Okay, so you have widths of right-of-way that are smaller than 60 feet, down to approximately how much?
Some areas we have a 10-foot right-of-way, but I'm just saying it looks like you've got very large,
you're just
very
out of luck.
Lots.
10 feet.
So have you really tried to implement like vegetated swales where you
On a typical street you'd have in Seattle a 25-foot driving lane so that two cars can pass with a line down the middle and then parking on either side. That's a typical city street. So I don't really know what you would do with a 10-foot right-of-way, but my guess is perhaps the city's right-of-way is larger in many other areas. So I would concentrate on the actual streets that are wider, and the 10-foot ones, I don't know what to do with.
Could I have you stand?
What kind of soils are you dealing with? If you have like, we have very thick clay layers. So were you working with clay, and how did you amend it?
I'm going to let Tracy answer that. You need a microphone.
Can you use the microphone there? If you turn it on for me.
Let's just hold on that question until after my presentation, because I go through some soils discussion.
So re-ask if I don't answer it in my presentation.
I just wanted to ask if your case studies are publicly available, or are they published on the web? Could students access them and that sort of thing?
Yes, we have an incredible amount of information on our website, everything from the technical drawings to the projects to the scopes of work. I'm not sure about the business cases. They should go up as well. We'd like to do that, but if you contact us, we'll email you the business case. That's actually one of the best ways for you to learn how we develop the project is through the business case. That's a great idea.
We're going to condition a developer to build that for us. The capital expense will be on them. So it'll be ours in perpetuity after the warranty expires. How do we maintain it, and what does it cost?
Maintenance of our systems, we did as part of the business case. We had to look at comparing it to maintenance of a typical catch basin system. And they pretty much break even. And we even built, you know, we were very conservative in the natural systems on how to approach it. So we looked at replacing all the soils in every swale every 15 years, even though we absolutely don't believe that that's what we're going to have to do. So again, the vegetation maintenance goes to the property owners, but the structural part of the system is what we would do. So we'd clean, make sure the outlets were clear of debris. We have assumed replacing soils in the swales every 15 years, and like I said, we don't expect it. But that breaks even when we do our business case to a traditional sending in the vector truck to, you know, suck the leaves out of the. We took a different approach. So in other words, many developing areas try to put in your standards first. So your ordinances, your standards about how to build. We had to start with, well, we just have to prove that it works and retrofit a street. Now go back and institutionalize, is what you're saying. How do we institutionalize this? And we just finished a street use manual where, unfortunately, it's not a requirement, but we did get it as an alternative to an alternative street design. So, yes, we have now in our street design manual the LID approach. I'd like to see it in our creek watershed areas, a standard that must be done as opposed to an alternative. So I'm going to turn it over to Tracy because I'll make sure she has enough time.
I'm going to try to get into the design of the principles that we've used and share a lot of our lessons learned. So if you do go into constructing any of these projects or design that you... don't repeat the same mistakes that we have. So there's a lot of different opportunities for putting in your projects. We did initially a lot of focus on our creek. We did a lot of in-creek work and then really realized that you really need to work in the upper watershed to try to change the hydrologic regime. And that's when we started in on our right-of-way projects. And we worked a lot on the right-of-way first, and now we're getting back into the private property development standards, again, because our right-of-ways are 20-25% of the city, and so there's a lot of opportunity there, and our area is also already developed. So I'm going to talk about some of the design principles and then get into some case studies. I just want to highlight, I don't know how I sound, it seems like it's going back and forth. Can you hear me okay? So primary things, there's the vegetation. The vegetation's main role is to help support the infiltration properties of the soil. We found on this first project that Denise mentioned, we put it in 1999, our infiltration rates are actually increasing with time. There's only one way that that can be happening, and that's this, the microbes that the vegetation and the healthy soil are supporting are maintaining that infiltration rate. Any of the engineers know any infiltration facility, you usually are putting on really large factors of safety because they decrease with time. So this idea that bioretention maintains your infiltration rate is incredibly positive for using these types of facilities. Surface storage is the element that holds the peak of your, you know, most the average street is the average of this is about 6%, but parts of it are up to 8%. And so I wanted to create stepped flat pool areas. And then you could have surface storage that is very shallow, like out at our High Point project, which I'll discuss in a little bit, where this is only 2 inches of ponding created by soil berms. A lot goes into the specifications to make it so that somebody would construct it to that level of detail. And then one of the huge design elements is soil. Seattle used to have a mile high of glaciers on top of it. Our soil varies dramatically all over the place. This is kind of your typical soil that we have. This is beach sand, and this is like a clay, hard pan, really low infiltration rate. Those three sites, this is the project Denise mentioned, it's 32 acres. They were all within a couple blocks of each other. So really important during your design process to go out and actually test your infiltration rate. Don't do it based off of soil typing. Literally dig a hole, fill it with water, and see how long it takes to drain. There's methodology specifics in our Department of Ecology manual. It's called their pit test. It's just the best way to go about it. We've tried several different options, and that's the only one that has consistently good results. Even with that, you know, we do like 2 per block now, and still you end up with some spots that during construction you might end up having to put in a slotted pipe, because if it's hard clay, and your infiltration rate is 0, it will remain zero. And so it really depends what... If you have sites that are hard clay, you need to have a different design approach that doesn't rely on infiltration. Our High Point project, which I'll talk about a little bit, was on top of a steep slope. So although we might have been able to get some infiltration, we didn't want to encourage it. And so we got our benefit by having 4 foot of soil imported by a retention soil and then actually recollecting it in a slotted pipe. And that's something that you could do if you have clay soils. That's something that we did on this particular swale. The imported soil, the bioretention soil, there's a lot that goes into that. I've had somebody recently call me from Tennessee. He had dug all his swales and he was ready to fill them, and then he realized he didn't know what dirt to put back in. We run a lot of tests, the hydraulic conductivity, to try to come up with what soil mix will meet our goals. You're never going to get a design infiltration rate greater than 1 inch per hour. I don't care who, well, actually, in 4 or 3 years, I forget what it is, but there's some good testing at different compaction rates. Okay, so just those with the principles, and then I want to talk about some of the projects. Again, we focused initially in the right-of-way with our big grid projects. That's single-family, low-density residential. Then we moved into higher-density, 60% impervious with 55-foot right-of-ways and wider roads. Our next step will be to be working in a commercial area, and then I'll talk a little bit about some private property work. So Denise has talked a bit about the C Street project. I'm going to highlight some of the street design elements that have changed just as we worked through projects. That first project, the sidewalk was separated. The Broadview Green Grid, we brought the sidewalk up adjacent to the road, again serving as an emergency vehicle passing area. Before any of our projects, I should mention, we do traffic speeds and volumes to get a sense of really what is the neighborhood experiencing and what level of safety do we need to incorporate. You know, something on a very busy road would have different standards than something on a smaller residential road. These roads, you know, pretty much get the traffic of the people who live there and a few people cutting through some of these smaller roads. Then once you're into the multifamily neighborhood like High Point, it's a different set of standards. So again, the first C Street sidewalk separated, skinnier road with parking that was pull-off parking spaces. Realized that by the time we put in all the parking spaces that people requested, you actually get less impervious area if you make your road wider and have parallel parking. It's also a lot less design time because you don't have to talk with every homeowner and discuss how many parking spaces do you really want. And it's just, here it is, it's public parking. It's not perceived as private parking spaces, which the pull-off spaces are sometimes perceived as. And then this was one of our big storms, and we're just so excited to see it fill up with water even before the construction was done. What we learned on that project, the Broadview project, is really you can direct more water into these systems than I initially thought. So, you know, maybe I was being a little conservative in some of the earlier designs. So our next set of projects, we realized, well, you know, we've got 50 acres instead of the 32, and if we direct water from these upper areas onto project streets in the lower areas, then we can still achieve our end goal at the end of the system. It's not quite an end-of-pipe project, but it's then your roadway, just your average planting strip, 5 or 6 feet, and your sidewalk on the other side. Because so much space goes into grading, and what really is the priority for me is the bottom swale area. That's where all the infiltration, the majority of the infiltration occurs. If you use this offset template, you pretty much double the amount of infiltration surface that you have. And so, you know, that gets back to your right-of-way design questions. If you do everything on one side of the street, you may have a skinnier swale bottom, so you maybe not be able to direct 3 times the adjacent drainage area into it, but you can still get a lot of benefit. Each project, the numbers will be different depending on your native soil and how much, how much bottom swale area you can get in. A lot of that depends on what kind of safety standards you work out with your Department of Planning and Development on the private property side and your street design professionals. Our design criteria as of general, the primary things that direct it. The 2-foot shoulder from your edge of pavement, grade down at a 3-to-1 slope. We can have 1 foot of vertical on this side of the street. On the back side, we could really have it a rockery wall batter. But if it gets greater than 4 feet, we do put in fencing. And we don't have any of our swales greater than 4 feet from the edge of the roadway down to the bottom of the swale. And all that, our street design guidelines, I could give to anyone if they are interested. So this is that offset template in construction. This project is currently under construction, so I don't have any finished photos yet. But it is turning out to have a very nice aesthetic. There wasn't any equity issues for people on the block of like, oh, you know, this person gets the swale on one side of the street and all I get is the sidewalk. You know, people didn't seem to have too many issues with that. Construction costs. I just wanted to highlight the breakdown of where the different costs go. Stormwater elements and street improvement elements are about equal. In the stormwater elements, I include all the soil, and all of our designs include 1 foot at minimum of bioretention soil throughout all of the swale area, side slope and bottom. So that excavation and reimporting of soil is not a landscape cost, but it is what makes the vegetation support. It's probably why we have such little need for replanting of projects. The vegetation does incredibly well out there. Because it has such healthy soil. So the 13% for landscaping is truly just the plant costs. Again, the street design elements, and kind of thinking about it from the construction standpoint and the impact to homeowners, you know, we do dig out some very large pits during construction and then we fill them back out with soil. But as Denise said, there's a couple weeks there where the homeowners usually have a really hard time. So be prepared from that from the project management standpoint. The street design standards, there's 6 pages of them, so I just wanted to remind myself to offer that. If you are starting to develop them, I can forward ours on. So this is the High Point neighborhood. This one is the, I think it's a 56-foot right-of-way, 60% impervious. They really wanted the planting strip as a growable space, as a playable space, and that was what directed the shallow depth of ponding and the grass-lined swales in a lot of the area. My preference would always be a vegetated system because of the ability to mulch the system and my impression that that the vegetation and the soil help support that long-term infiltration rate and the diversity would be more beneficial than just a monoculture of grass. But we'll find that out over the long term. So this project, again, when your site restrictions get different, sometimes your goals get a little different. This swale system is designed for the 6-month storm to allow infiltration of the full 6-month storm, whereas all of our other projects, it's up to the 2-year storm. And so this is the project where we also have the combination with the big detention pond, and that's because of, you know, kind of squeezing all of our swale into, the bottom swale width is like 2 feet. So it just really depends on how much space that you can secure for your natural drainage system as opposed to all the other elements. And because it was so skinny, we had to go down pretty deep. And so construction-wise, this again, we had 4 feet of imported bioretention soil before we recollected the water in a slotted pipe. I feel very strongly that it should be a slotted pipe, not a perforated pipe. Slotted pipe protected by a foot of a filter gravel material, not filter fabric. And our geotechs can provide you more information on that if that seems surprising to you. On redevelopment projects, you all might have the same problem. Skinny space for lots of utilities. And so keep some extra time up front for negotiations, not just with your street designers of the surface element, but maybe your city light or your electrical folks about how to get the underground power to all the houses while you're trying to fit all of this natural drainage system 5-foot depth section of soil.